We are sitting here in Los Gatos. As a matter of fact, I mean, technically it's
Monte Sereno.
And I am at the beautiful, beautiful home of Kevin Euclid. Now, I got to say, dude, the last time that I was in this area, I went out, if I'm not mistaken, to the Los Gatos Brewing Company, which is what you now own.
Correct.
Correct.
Yeah.
And you're remodeling, you're redoing it. And I got to say, before we get into that, I overindulged that night to the point where I couldn't drive home. But I don't really know anybody in this area. And I was sitting there, and it was the middle of winter. And I had met some of my high school boys, like Brian O'Shea, Zach Walsh, big old crew, Kevin Byron, nice little reunion thing. Well, these guys kind of bounced early. Next thing you know, I was talking, And I'm like, dude, how am I going to get home? Now, O'Shea doesn't really live anywhere near here. Byron doesn't really live anywhere near here. Either did Walls. Walls lives in Arizona. I was way too intoxicated to drive. And I had no other option to do what? Sleep in my car. But
because there was no Uber and Lyft back in the day.
Dude, exactly. So here I was in Los Angeles. The other thing is I can't leave my car. I mean, if I go back to Half Moon Bay, it's 45 minutes back to Half Moon Bay.
Oh, at least.
I don't want to go back to Half Moon Bay and then have to come back here the next day. So what did I do? Now, this is, no, granted, you have to understand this. It was freezing. I mean, freezing balls, dude. So I got in the car. And this is kudos to my drunk self. I realize that if you get in the car and you start the engine.
I was just ready to ask the same question.
Right. And you turn on the heater and you're lying or you're even sitting in the driver's seat. That's full blown DUI.
Correct.
So what did I do? Got in the car, turned on the engine. And laid down in the back seat.
Oh, my God.
So I could have the heater running.
I really thought you were going to say you were in the trunk. I thought you were going to say you're like going to put the back seat down and you were in the trunk. That would be more of a Burnsy move, in my opinion. Like, you really thought through it way too much.
I really – it's probably one of my prouder moments just because of usually when you're inebriated like that, you don't make like good conscious decisions. And at that point, that was one that actually worked out well.
I'm glad, you know, because that's something that will always haunt most athletes, especially now. It's that mugshot, you know? I mean,
just one time.
All it takes is one time. And I think somebody I know told me it's like $12,000 they spent on a DUI.
Yeah.
And I just thought to myself, dude, what if you just spent every time you went out, no matter where you went, if you took an Uber, there's no way within 5 years or whatever you're going to get up to that limit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of, you know, what we have now in society.
Yeah. I mean, that and, I mean, the obvious, you're putting somebody else's life at risk.
There's a lot of variables that, it's never a good thing, you know. And that's the hard part of, like you said, like we just, you know, owning a brew pub, and probably the biggest worry is, you know, over-serving and people leaving and just trying to say, hey, you know, Uber, Lyft, do whatever you can to get home, or just don't drink and drive. You know, it's as simple as that. But, you know, that's definitely the dangers and worries that I have down the road. And I'm telling you, I'm not looking forward to it, but, you know, it's going to be fun when you come back and see a whole different, you know, brew pub and restaurant that's a lot different. So we're getting close. July, we're going to be open, so we're excited.
What's this process been like?
Oof. Well, I always joke around and say I'd rather be hitting Familia's sliders right now with them against him, but it's tough, man. It's you do something for so long, and when you play in Major League Baseball, as my dad always gives an analogy, you're one of the top 30 if you're a starter in the world at what you do. You're the top in your profession. So over that time, and you have success, you know, you get a little ego, or you get, you know, a little bit of something. You have to humble yourself at times. You think you're a lot smarter than everyone else in different ways. And with, I think the biggest problem with athletes are is when they leave the realm of sports on top and they've had successes, there's a whole other world out there that's the reality that you don't even know about. Unless while you're playing, you're getting into business and you're, you know, you're a very smart guy that's just knows exactly from education in college to maybe taking some risks, failing a little bit, because the only way you really gain as much knowledge as possible in life, in my opinion, is you have to fail sometimes, you know? So I think I see now more than ever why some athletes struggle after their playing days with businesses. And you have to surround yourself with good people. And, you know, I'm doing this with my brother, so that's a good thing. And we've got a good team together. But, you know, it's definitely taken more money. It's taken more time. You think you have a perfect model in place, throw it out the window. You know, add 30%, add 30% more in time. So it's going along. It's definitely a lot more than I thought it'd be on a lot of different ends, but it's definitely a good life lesson. Even through the failures that we've had so far, it's been really good.
Your brother's been in the restaurant industry for a number of years.
Correct. Yeah. So he went to Indiana University, got his business degree. Then he went on to go to culinary school at Johnson & Wales in Providence, Rhode Island. I think it's number two behind the NYU but the culinary school in New York. But he just slowly moved out. My uncle had a restaurant in New York, so he worked there with my uncle a little bit, and then went to Colorado, had a little brief stint, and then he moved to San Francisco, which is, you know, the mecca of culinary food in a lot of ways. And the reason it's the mecca because the produce is so close. You know, California just produces so much great, you know, agricultural, you know, and things that come out of here. I mean, I didn't even know until I moved to California, like all the almonds that you eat are from California, and just little things like that. So he's been in the restaurant business since, he just turned 40 this year, so probably close to over 15 years.
Name of the brew co?
It's going to be called Loma Brewing Company. And we're surrounded by hills, and Loma is Spanish for the hill. Also, Loma Prieta is a very famous, well, not a good famous thing that
fault.
Happened here. And the fault. And but, you know, it's a beautiful area here in Los Gatos, and we're surrounded by hills. And just we went through hundreds of names. And it's so hard to name something in the wine business and alcohol or beer or anything because there's so many names of things out there now and trademarks and all this different stuff. So we settled on this. We think it's going to be an easy name. The thing I said to our brewer today, he was asking about the name and all that. And I said, hey, the greatest part about it is no one can mispronounce this. It's L-O-M-A. Mm-hmm. Most people are going to say Loma. Hmm. And if they don't, maybe I don't know where they're going to stumble on that one. But
now, your story is very interesting because – you grew up in Ohio. You
Correct.
Were a Bearcat at University of Cincinnati. Obviously, spent a number of years with the Red Sox in Boston. Then it was the White Sox after that, at which time the next move was Japan?
No, Yankees.
Yankees,
yeah,
that's
so
right.
Next year was Yankees, and then after that, I went to Japan.
And then after Japan, at what point did you realize you were done?
Well, after so I was in Japan, and I made
a good living over in Japan, right? I mean, you had a nice contract to continue to play.
Yeah. So I had a contract, and the way the greatest part about Japan too is no one knows your contract. They don't tell people what your contract.
Really,
it's a guess. But the way I got the way I was structured in my deal was it was for X amount of dollars. I got paid half of it up front. That's the way the team wanted to do it. You know, and for me, what happened was I got over there and my plantar fasciitis came back after 7 years. I didn't have any problems. And next thing you know, my plantar fasciitis just killed me. And I was dying. I mean, I'm coming out like the seventh inning. I'm like barely standing on my left foot. Like trying to figure out ways to basically just alleviate that stress that's put on. And I just knew. I knew then it was like, man, I had back surgery the year before, herniated disc, L4, L5, worked my butt off to get my back in the best shape ever. I lost a ton of weight. I thought that would be, you know, the big thing with that. But, you know, it's funny when the doctors told me after the herniation, it's like the weight's not the issue. You know, you're not an over obese and, you know, all this stuff. You're fine. But for me, I just said, I want to get in the best shape of my life because in my mind, I said, well, I think it is probably if I get heavier, it will help. and if I am heavier, it will hurt me more, not help. So I was in the best shape, and then next thing you know, my foot went out, and I was just like, man, I'm just tired. I'm tired of grinding out these injuries. I'm tired of it. Became work. Baseball became a lot of work for me because it wasn't just going out there and going in the cage and hitting batting practice. It was like taking care of my body to the most I've ever had to take care of my body and every little thing and every part of the day. And that's when I just knew, like, and also it didn't help that I also, right, my wife was pregnant when we were in Japan, and our third child came in October of that year. And I love my kids. I love being around my family. And baseball is as much as there's so many great things that come out of baseball, I would say the lifestyle of family is probably the hardest, one of the hardest, because there's many jobs out there that parents get taken away from their children.
You're drafted in the eighth round by the Boston Red Sox in 2001. And then you made your debut in May of 2004. The team that broke the curse. When you think back to that year, what's going to resonate with you?
Oof, there's so many great memories. I mean, I'll never forget the phone call in AAA in Charlotte. We didn't even get to play a game there yet, and I get a phone call, and my AAA manager, who's actually our AA manager with the Cubs, who I work for now, which is kind of funny, but I get that, and he says, hey, do you have your passport? And I'm like, oh my God, for some reason I had my passport. I mean, no one has their passport unless they're probably a foreign player, right? So I had my passport, and I'm like, oh yeah, I do. And he's like, oh, well, good thing you're going to Toronto. And I'm like, what? I was like, oh my God, what happened? Because you watch the games. I mean, you're AAA, you're watching the major leagues. Next thing I fly to Toronto, I don't know if I'm in the hotel. Tito calls me after the game. Boom, you're in there. I think that first day of like getting the call saying you're playing tomorrow might resonate as one of the greatest individual things for me.
Uh-huh.
And going in and seeing the number 20 with my last name on it, because when you play for the Red Sox, your home jersey doesn't have your name on it. You know, the away jersey only has your name on it. So the cool part about that is I got to see my name with my number for the first time, and I'm in the major league. So individually, I'd say that first game, I hit a home run in my second at bat, my first hit ever, which was amazing. But that team and what I learned – from that team, probably taught me so many great things. We had so many different characters, so many different types of guys, and so many different personalities that probably if you're in regular society, most guys wouldn't hang out. But what is so great with baseball is you don't need to be best friends, but you can become this group that's unstoppable in some ways because it's a psychological thing, and that's what that team had. That team had guys that were veterans that were dying themselves to get their first World Series. And some of those guys, it was going to be their multiple one. But everyone knew in the back of their mind that there was a so-called curse. And everyone in that room pretty much said, F the curse. We're going to take this thing down. And that's how we went on to win it.
A guy that I work with at MLB Network, Kevin Millar.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd start thinking about some of the other guys on that team. Mark Bellhorn. And,
yeah.
And almost like you said, I think the two of them could be any more opposite, right?
Oh, no. Yeah, no.
Here's Bellhorn. He's a super shy guy. I mean, totally, you know, even-keeled, mellow-mannered, and has been that way really his entire life. And then you have Millar, who's ultimate extrovert. And then you could throw in personalities like
Curt Schilling,
Big, Pedro Martinez,
right.
Manny Ramirez.
Big Poppy.
David
early,
Ortiz,
early Big Poppy too.
Johnny Damon.
Yeah, the leaders were
wow.
The leaders of that team. And sometimes when you're a rookie, you don't realize, right? Everyone, like I was the youngest guy on that team. I think Bellhorn. So what happened? And then Lenny DiNardo was also a Rule 5 guy that came up, and he kind of got hit away here and there. Like he had an injury, but he didn't have, you know, stuff like that happens to keep him around because they thought, you know, he could be a role player down the road, so you kind of hold on to him in different ways. But I literally was like the only rookie there at times. And, you know, rookie duties, carry the beer to the buses. And I'm living the life like, yes, I'll carry – how many? I got two arms. I can put 8 bags on, you know, grocery style, you know. And it was just all the personalities there that taught me so much. And it wasn't just the best player. it was the bench guys too. I mean, Dave McCarty, like, you know, he was a great influence for me. Curtis Laskanik was a great friend on that team, who great leader, funny, great teammate. But there were so many little intricate pieces on that team that were so vital for that team to be good. Kevin Millar was great because he could loosen up a clubhouse. Johnny Damon kept it loose. You know, this is the same guy that'd be in – he'd be basically in his boxer briefs doing pull-ups right before the game, like 10 minutes before the game. And next thing you know, like we always joked around, he's on second base in 15 minutes, you know? And this guy was – and Johnny was just such a great guy to me, took me out. Like, and these guys, they made me play cards every day, you know? So they made me feel at home. And I got thrown right in. So Bill Miller got surgery too, so I was right in there, you know? So they knew that they can mess with me and joke with me and do the rookie, you know, what people call hazing, which I don't call it hazing. It's just – it's helping you get through it. And the greatest lesson I learned was that year was – if people aren't making fun of you and talking to you, there's a reason for that. It's a good thing when you're getting quote-unquote hazed as a rookie because they care about you and they're having fun with you. The moment they just give up on you after a while is the moment you got to worry because they don't want you around.
Take me back to down 3-0.
Oof.
American League Championship Series.
That was so, of course, I was a – you know, so I had, you know, you rent an apartment, and then next thing you know, you get out of your apartment because you're a rookie. You're making, you know, well, league minimum's a lot of money, you know, a lot less than it was back then, but still a lot of money in life. But I got out of my apartment. I'm in a hotel, and I'm just thinking, like, oh my God, I got to pack up all my stuff and this and that. And kind of living out of the hotel, so that kind of helped. But I wasn't on the roster that round. I was on the first with against the Angels, and then later on the World Series. But I just remember hanging out with Ellis Burks. You know, Ellis Burks and I were hanging out, going out in New York and having a good old time, but just talking and thinking about, oh, my God, what's going to happen? Like, and the worst part about it is you can't – when you're not able to even pinch hit, it's such a nerve-wracking moment. Like, I was so nervous, like, oh, the whole time just nervous.
Really?
It's way more nerve-wracking, in my opinion. I'd rather be on the field, even though it's nerve-wracking at times.
Sure.
Oh, no way. Like, I'd rather be able to field a ball. I'd rather be able to hit a ball. I'd rather be able to do something where I can control something and do something great within the game. And now you might make that error or you might strike out, but at least you have that chance to make the play.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we were down. And I just remember Millar. I mean, you see the videos of him joking around like, hey, don't, you know, and all the guys in the clubhouse, that their attitude was, hey, if we win this game tonight, guess who's on the bump tomorrow? And then guess who's on the bump the next day? And then guess who's on the bump? Because our offense, they weren't scared. Like, our hitters, they weren't scared. I mean, you had Manny and David back-to-back that anything could happen. And then you had guys like Bill Miller, Trot Nixon, Johnny. You know, all these guys at any point could be the big dog. And they were.
What was Manny like? For those baseball fans who would listen to this, everyone remembers the scuffle that the two of you guys got into in the dugout.
Yeah, that was
what year was that?
Oh God, what year? The year I'm the worst at the years.
Yeah, whatever.
I'm good with 04 and 07. I got all those down. And 2011, the collapse. Everyone always asks about. But
you got the two rings that remind you of 04.
Yeah, so they all kind of. For me, I think I was just so intense during games that it just washed away. But Manny was the greatest right-hand hitter I've ever seen in my life. And I learned – I am definitely thankful for Manny in just setting an example every day hitting. He didn't necessarily work with you. He wouldn't talk hitting. But the greatest part about Manny, he didn't need to talk hitting. All you had to do if you were a smart player – and not saying that I'm smarter than other players because every player watched Manny Ramirez, right, when he hit. And you would try to get something out of it like, oh, my God, look what he does, right? But I feel – like, every day that I got to watch him play and watch him hit and evaluate his swing made me realize the things I needed to improve on to stay at the top level. And he taught me so much about hitting that I tried to – even like in 2005, I got sent down 5 times. I would take all the stuff I learned from him and other guys on the team, but mainly him and his swing, and try to implement it on how I could do it. And I'll tell you, like, yeah, we got in a scuffle one time, and, you know, the big thing was, and I was at fault, at this, and Manny was at fault too. I mean, there's 50-50 on this, but basically what happened was I played every day. And I was playing every day, and I'll forget what month it was, but then the fight broke out between Coco and James the same day as James Shields. And I had an off day that day. So I think this was 2008 because Sean Casey was on that team. So, yeah, it was 2008. There's my good memory. It came back. Hmm. But and what happened was there was so Coco gets thrown out of the game, right? Because he charged the mound against Shields. He's gone. Somebody had to come in. Somebody else gets hurt. We have no outfielders. Well, in 2006, I played a little outfield. So they throw me in on my off day, like, you know, and whatever. I mean, you play every day, whatever. But I was hurting. I was hurting pretty bad, right? And go out to right field. Never played Fenway. Like, I don't think I've ever played Fenway right field, which, as you know,
is one of the hardest in all of baseball, right. If not the hardest. I'll take that back. It is the hardest.
Yeah, it has to be. And so I have to go play right field. So I get up the next inning. Wally Bell, you know, great guy. God rest his soul. But he ran 3-0 pitch from J.P. Howell. Never forget it. At least a foot off the plate. 3-0. I'm like, oh, come on, Wally, dude. Like, seriously? I just came in this game. Like, next thing you know, I crush a ball into right center field. Somebody runs it down. And I'm just pissed. Like, just pissed off. And whatever, the game, you know, and I was just mad. And my frustrations got the better of me that day.
Sure. It happens to all of us.
Right.
Okay,
so
you come in the dugout.
And my intensity sometimes would rub off on some guys the wrong way. You know, and that's one thing that it's hard sometimes because you don't think you're doing something wrong. You think your intensity, you care, and the way you go about your business, you think is the right way in a lot of ways. And in baseball, sometimes people don't see the same way as you. And I think that's what happened with Manny and I in that situation was a little scuffle. And he said, yeah, something, you know, whatever. He just told me, hey, just sit down and shut up. And I basically told him, I said, F off, Manny. You know, like, you know, I ain't talking to you. I'm talking to the umpire, this and that. I'm mad because I'm in this game because he was DHing too. He wouldn't play outfield. That's why. And there was all this craziness, whatever, anyways.
So there was a lot more going on in the backstory. Yeah. I kind of assume, just from watching it, because we've seen it happen 100 times, is the hitter makes an out. He comes in, tosses a helmet, obviously ricochets and hits him or something, or usually has to do with some sort of piece of equipment. It might be a bat, right?
Yeah, so there was
I had nothing to do with that.
No, I was bitching and moaning.
Okay.
You know, I was bitching and moaning that day. I was acting like a little bitch that day.
We all do. Again.
A little bitch assness, as we like to call it. But, I was in this. And then he said that, and I just said, and probably no one's told him, you know.
Like, yeah.
And so then he goes up to bat. He walked, and he comes in the dugout, and I'm getting ready to go get my glove to go out the field. And he said, if you got something to say to me, come down in the – downstairs. I said, I ain't got nothing to say to you. I said, you're the one talking, you know, crap to me. And next thing you know, he just took his helmet in his hand and just swung at me and hit me in the chin.
Really?
Yeah. And then just everyone, you know, bounced off. And next thing you know,
I mean, what'd you do when he took that helmet and hit you in the chin? Then what was your next?
Well, I got backed up. Like in that dugout, you know, you take one step and you're pinballing around.
You're hitting a pole.
Yeah.
Right?
You're in trouble in that dugout if you don't. And so it just got broken up and nothing ever happened. But, I was mad. I was fired up. But, you know, it's just one of those things. It happens.
Then
you know?
Did you go back out to the right field after that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. We didn't have any players. Like, yeah, so I got – it was like basically just felt like a bad rug burn on the chin. Like, I think my goatee saved me in some ways. But I thought I was bleeding. Like, you know, you get hit that one time. But it was all good. I mean, you know, we make amends and it was all good.
Did you guys ever come together and, I don't know, talk about it, or is it just one of those things that slowly went away?
Well, it took a day or two, and then Veritek told me, he's like, hey, you know, you need to go say something. And I'm thinking to myself, like, wait, I got like 4 years in the big leagues, like, and, you know, and then I was like, you know what, he's right. And I'm thinking of all the things, like, well, no, he's Manny Ramirez, you should say, apologize, you know. And I'm like, okay, I'll be the bigger man. So we go up, we talk, and it was all good. And it was fine. And we worked together with the Cubs, you know, last year and all that. And it's all good. I mean, I saw them and I don't have any animosity because there's a part of the game that stuff, as much as you don't like, you know, as much as the media and the fans don't like to see it, there's something about it, man. I mean, sometimes guys just need to get it off their chest and, you know, you need to get in a little scuffle. I mean, you don't want to sit there and beat the crap out of each other like it's UFC, but, you know, it's not unhealthy. I mean, there are unhealthy environments where things break out, but there are healthy times where, you know, teams need that. Teams need to get, you know, get some stuff off their chest. And, I mean, look at the Nationals. You know, last year, it's the end of the world, trade Papelbon, this, that. Nationals are playing great baseball this year. You know, time heals a lot of wounds, and I think that's the key.
They still should have traded Papelbon. There is no way in my he's had some success in the early going. He's also blown it. I know of at least one save that just recently happened, but it's a different scenario when I look at, say, you and Manny. That looks like a normal grind, whatever. But when you have a relief pitcher that just came over, that just got traded over there,
right,
going to clash, going head to head with your best player, that's. And Papelbon seemingly has worn out his welcome in a lot of different places.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not here to judge Papelbon and all that stuff. I think also, too, sometimes young players get a little over their skis.
I agree.
Get humbled.
I agree.
Is that the right way to handle it? I don't know. Did it work? Who knows? Mm-hmm. Maybe it did. I don't know. I don't know enough about that situation to really warrant, like, what – who. And I don't care to take sides. All I know is I think in that scenario, the one thing that got me with the Bryce Harper thing is kind of his comments in the offseason. And I actually saw Bryce Harper last year at the Super Bowl, and I love his game. I love the way he plays hard, and then, you know, when he's playing too hard, people are moaning and groaning about that. You know, and that's in the life of the superstar. You can never be perfect in the eyes of the people, right? So, but the one thing I would have to say about the whole Bryce Harper thing, I think being an MVP, being a young player, the comments he made in the offseason – were one, I just wish he would have talked about his fan base and his team improving rather than all of the flair and the flash in the game.
So you're talking about make baseball fun again.
Whatever that is. I don't mm-hmm. understand that. I don't know if that's a
it's just whatever. Whatever.
Is that today or what's tomorrow, right? I don't know. But my big thing with that was if I'm his PR team, if I'm Boris, I think he's Boris, right? I would say, Bryce, you just won the MVP. Talk about your team's failures and how you are going to make sure that that doesn't happen again. As a young player, as an MVP-type talent, put the attention to the fans that were so excited for you guys to win the World Series. Number, you know, you have all this talent. Well, now you're talking about things that are individual. You need to revert it back to the team. Because as an MVP, and then Mike Trout comes and says what he says, and then people are like, oh, Mike Trout's the best. Mm-hmm. Well, Mike Trout and Bryce Harper are two of the best players in the game. But sometimes people handle stuff differently. And maybe Bryce 10 years from now will laugh and say, man, I should never say that. Or maybe he fully agrees with it, and baseball should be more fun, and guys should pimp more home runs and all that. I know one thing as a retired player, it's not our choice. You know, so when Goose goes on and says, you know, what he says, I love Goose. He's hilarious. Mm-hmm. But – and he's entitled to his opinion. It's all opinion, right? It's not right or wrong. It's just how you perceive it and how you want to be in the game. So for me, I just think that was my big thing with Bryce in that whole situation was I just think he could have handled being the MVP and talking about different things. But, hey, I think he's young. I think he's a great talent. I think he's here to stay. I mean, what, he had 13 walks in a series? I mean, come on, 6 walks in a game?
That's thanks to you guys walking him every single time. Was that
– respect.
Did you hear? Did you hear anything about the strategy? I mean, you're dialed in. You're a special assistant for the Chicago Cubs, and I know, you know, there's obviously a ton of communication that goes on between you and in the front office mainly.
Yeah, I have a very small role, okay. So I mean, I hear stuff. I ask. I try to pick Joe Madden's brain, Theo's brain, and just because you just have to learn. Especially the best part is too is to learn from people that you don't always agree with, right? That's, to me, like, there's so many different people in baseball, like, there's so many different ways of going about it. So the more you can learn in baseball about, like, this person thinks this way, okay, so why do you think this way? And why does this way work? And why does this way work? Right? We're all different people. So I try to pick their brains, but knowing Joe Maddon the way he's not going to let the best player beat him. Well, I mean, why would you? I mean, if you think about it, it's the same way in all sports. LeBron James is – you're going to double-team LeBron. You're going to let the other guy – you know, let's let this guy score 30 points and beat us.
Sure.
We're not going to let LeBron score 50, right? and that's how sports is. You know, you have to take down the strongest weapon. You know, and I'm guessing that's the case. It's like, well, hey, we're not going to give him anything here where he can just annihilate the ball and hurt our chances of winning the series.
We haven't seen anything like this since Barry Bonds. And ironically, Joe Maddon was the bench coach for the Angels back in the 2002 World Series, in which they walked Barry Bonds 13 times.
Oh, yeah.
So but it does make sense. Why would you possibly let your best player beat you? Now, still to this point, I understand how people would want to make comparisons, and the comparisons in the early going make a lot of sense between Bryce Harper and Barry Bonds. We take their numbers and put them next to each other. But Bryce Harper's not Barry Bonds. He's not what Barry Bonds was.
No one is the king.
No, dude, I mean, that was...
No one. What he
have did. Have you ever seen anything like that? I mean, just like you said, like, I played with Manny Ramirez, the greatest right-handed hitter I've ever seen. He still wasn't even close.
He's close.
To what Barry Bonds was.
He's close to Barry Bonds.
You think so?
Out of all people, I'd say Manny's close. But he's, I mean, what that close is, that could be a wide gap. It could be a wide gap. I mean, what Barry did, and people bring up, and I hear people all the time, and
they're going to bring up the steroids and the PEDs.
I never did steroids. Mm-hmm. I can honestly sit here. I didn't do steroids. And people laugh. I'm like, my body's the same as it was then. It wasn't a great body. And I said, if I ever did steroids, I want a refund because it didn't change this body at all, right? So I always laugh about that. But, like, people don't understand, like, there were so many players that I played with in the minor leagues, college, that did steroids. Steroids are not going to make you the best player in the history of baseball. Like, I'm sorry, I don't believe it. I think it can better you in a lot of ways because you're healthier for the long run. You might have some more psychological, basically you're on this pedestal more because you feel better every day. But eye-hand coordination and getting the barrel of the ball, what he did, he would get sliders that would hit him in the kneecap, and he would just crush it into the bay. Like, you're like, what the heck? Like, that ball almost hit him. And the greatest part about him was he'd get one pitch a game.
Yeah.
And it'd be a left-on-left, like, out reliever that's dirty, coming sidearm. Bam, got him. Homer. And that'd be the only pitch you get all game. Like, that's insane.
People that watched you play, I mean, you had a very unique style about you. And I believe we're even basically glorified in the book Moneyball. I realized you were a main subject in the book talking about you and your walks and your ability to hone in the strike zone. Two things, a two-part sort of question here. Number one, how did you ever come up with the stance that you came up with? Let's start there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I call it I tell everyone it's the evolution of hitting. I had a Jeff Bagwell type wide stance in college. My hands were, funky, and then I just kept learning that I needed to get a little taller and move around, and I just kept trying. My brain just kept trying to figure out things, and then, like, the whole thing with Manny Ramirez, how he would hit and get his hands that position, get that load, and I just couldn't move my hands in different direction and do things. I couldn't stand still. I always, even in college, I had 10 different batting stances my freshman year and trying to figure it out. My coach was all over me. And next thing you know, after my freshman year, he just let me go. And I came up with this funky stance. And the reason I didn't get drafted until I was a senior, I put up unbelievable numbers in college. Like, if I showed them to you, you'd be like, wow, that's pretty impressive, right? And I never got it. I made, like, second team all conference one year. And I led the league in batting average. It was like top 50 in the country in college sports. So, like, there was always this thing about my stance. And it was funky in college, and then it got funkier and funkier, and everyone always saw it as whatever. But it's like, what I've learned is if you watch players and they can get that barrel of the ball consistently, they're going to hit. You know, there's hitters, you know. They might not look the best or whatever. But for me, the way I got to that, I watched, man, I just played around with things, and I couldn't move my hands in certain ways, so I would just move my hand up and down the bat to try to get it in position to where I thought. And it was just all feel. Like, I would look and feel. Like, I didn't know what – like, I didn't look in the mirror. I didn't do any of that stuff. It was all feel. And it's so funky and so weird that you know, I always joke around. People are like, why'd you hit like that? I was, and I joke, and sometimes I get laughed. Some people go, huh? Like, is this guy, like, I say, you know, I just try to handcuff myself. I just thought it was really good, and I just try to handcuff myself and make my stance really odd. And some people think that's, you know, whatever, but.
What, now, what about your hands? Because your hands, at one point, now, I believe I watched several times where at contact.
Oh, yeah, they're
straight. They were back together.
Yeah, so I had that
card. You would start.
It was just a rhythm.
Four to 5 inches, real soft grip, I imagine. You have to be able to slide it back down.
Oh, yeah. Like Jason Baratek would always say, like, you got to play that violin, you know, or, you know, he's like, hey, you're not getting a violin action today. Or, you know, and guys would, and I think, and I had great teammates that kind of had fun with that. And they'd say, hey, you're not, well, and they would notice, like, hey, you got to do that more. You're not doing it. And it's just funny. It's just, I don't know. Like, but the one thing I do know is a fact of baseball is every individual is unique. You cannot hit exactly like another person. You might have a look that looks similar, but every batter is so different. And I tell all of our young players in the Cubs, you got to be yourself. You can watch the great players and how they hit, but you have to figure out how your body works because your muscles, your ligaments, everything is so different. And you're unique. And you have to figure out that uniqueness within and implement all the little parts, you know, psychologically more than anything. You know, when hitting, how many times it's a focal point. Like today, if you have 10 focal points going into a game, you're done, right? You can't have like, oh, if I get my toe down, if I get my head, you know, like,
of course,
I got to get my arms back. No, you're done. You have no chance that day. Mm-hmm. When you're going good, what happens? You don't think. You just step in the box and you're like, I got to have a 40-inch bat and a 40-ounce bat. And I'm.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, you're not getting this by me. You throw 99, I got it. You know, but when you're going bad, you think about everything. So I always tell guys, limit the amount of focal points, right? Figure it out. Get a focal point that's working for you. Like, okay, my hip, I got to do this, or my back shoulder, or my hands. But if you have five in the bag, you got no chance up there. I said, you got to figure out little things that can help you and implement into your daily routine that when you're going bad, you have that focal point to bring you back to where you need to be.
What about the walks?
The walks.
Was it something that
I just didn't want to swing. I was scared.
Nah. Let's go back to Little League. Did you walk a lot in Little League?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I mean, when you're in Little League, you know, like, it was never a big deal.
Were you the man?
Yeah, man. I was a good player. I was always
best
overlooked.
Best player in the league.
In high school, I was
Little League.
In Little League,
yeah.
I mean, in Cincinnati, we had some really good players.
Okay.
You know, Aaron Cook. I played with when I was 13 or 14 years old.
Sinker
he was a rival high school. So he was
there. I
played
with him in Colorado.
Yeah.
You faced him in the 2007 World Series.
Yes. Well, I don't – no, I didn't face him because I that's a funny story too. So I had to sit because of Poppy. So I was playing first base, and I was on fire.
In Colorado.
Yeah.
So they put him at first base.
Because the first two games were at home at Fenway, right?
Yep.
And I think I was like – In the ALCS, I was like, it was either 12 for 24 or 14 for 28 or something, just on fire, you know. So then the big thing, and then the next two games, I did good in the first two World Series games. I had good games.
Sure.
So then everyone's like, oh, my God, you can't take the hottest hitter out of the lineup, right?
Yeah.
And then so the media, of course, in Boston, what do? They want to see what I'm going to say because the choice is do you sit – David, or you sit Kevin Youkilis, and this is 2007, right? I just started playing every day in 2006, and it was funny. They tried to get me to bite on that, and I was just like, "Listen, we're two games away from winning the World Series. Do you think it matters if I start this game? I'm getting into this game at some point because I'm playing defense, and I'm probably going to pinch hit at some point or whatever. But like, it doesn't matter. Like, at this point, at this level, it's not about you anymore." And who is going to sit David Ortiz in a World Series game? I mean, Hall of Famer.
Dude, I'm looking at your numbers right here. I knew you were good. I mean, this is mind, but you had a career 382 on base percentage. You have a career OPS of 861. That is Hall of Fame caliber. The only thing you don't have is the longevity. If you had done what you did for 20 years,
well, look on there.
Holy
look on,
shit!
Look
dude.
On there and show you what my first full season, what my age was.
25.
No, first full season of playing.
Oh, by the time you started playing every day, it was just 27.
I was 27.
See, that's funny.
Old.
Same thing for me. So, by the time I really got my first chance to play every day, right. It's 27. But I was just like you. I was a college senior sign.
Right.
That.
How much did you sign for?
I signed for a bus ticket to Medford, Oregon, eighth rounder.
How much?
Oh, dude, it was $5,000. $5,000 and a
ooh,
$5,000 and a bus ticket.
That's great.
To Medford, Oregon.
But look at your story. Like, I was $12,000, right? We were together $17,000 and became major league players. That's the beauty of sports. And that's my message to all the kids out there and to all the parents out there. It doesn't matter if your kid's the first draft pick. He has there's more guys that play at the major league level every single day at the major leagues that aren't first rounders. It's okay.
What else sticks with you from the 2007 championship run?
2007 championship. I mean, we were down 3-1 against Cleveland. And we're facing CeCe Sabathia in the first inning. I was hitting second. So it's Pedroia, then me, then Poppy, then Manny. And we're down 3-1. I think it was game five. Yeah, I think it was game five. I think CeCe would have pitched game five, right? We're down 3-1. And my first at bat, get up against CeCe, right? First at bat, homer to left. And then literally it just was like, you know, first inning, we're up 1-0 on CeCe Sabathia, confidence booster, and then our team just rolled. Our pitchers, our hitters, it was awesome to watch. You watch a team, same thing in 2004. You're down, you're one game away from elimination, and then it becomes innings. You know, you're innings away from elimination. What do you got to do? You got to come together as a team, and you just got to grind. You got to get your walk. You got to take that base. You got to make that play. All that little stuff, and it was so cool to watch because 1-0 in Cleveland, boom, we win that game. Come home to Fenway Park, game six, game seven, blowout, party in Fenway Park to go to the World Series. And that was, to me, that epic comeback again. And the epic comeback was sweet and beautiful because we won in New York in 04.
Sure.
But this one was even cooler because we came back and won at home in front of our fans.
In 2004, were you guys taking shots of whiskey? And when did that start?
Well, I guess this is already put out there, right?
It's out there.
It's out there, thanks to Kevin Millar. And a lot of guys were not happy at Kevin, let me tell you. But that's the beauty of Kevin, right? You know you can't you know some part of your story is gonna get out there. You just hope it's not the whole story, right? Yes, guys had a little fun.
Was it a whole team thing? 25 guys getting together. Now, did this start? But when you guys were down,
I don't know if it was,
or was it going on through the course of the whole year?
And
it
No. It was just a thing in the playoffs. It was just I think it was just kind of like a joke. Like, I think it started as a joke. I'm not sure. And I don't know how it started, but it was pretty funny, like, where guys, like, and it was just, like, it wasn't even, like, a full. They were basically, like, a little cup and, like, a little bottom of it and just.
Bro, if this is going to make any of your 2004 Red Sox players feel any better, you guys weren't the first.
No.
Like, this shit went all the way back to Oakland.
Well, let's be honest.
When we would do it, and we'd kind of do it as, like, a slump buster.
Yeah.
It's like. You want to go into it.
It's rally beer or something.
Obviously. Now, I can say that I've seen some things where I literally have seen guys play with their eyes glazed over almost as if they had been drinking too much, and they would sip it through the whole course of the whole game.
That's
in the
wild.
Dominican Republic, they would drink rum and Cokes.
Right.
Brugal and Cokes, and they put it over in the corner. Now, the only thing that I would ever – obviously, I mean, to have any more than, say, one – but I would take a full big blowing shot of Crown Royal, which was my whiskey of choice. And I think the first time I ever did it was in Oakland and taught by a couple of veterans of like, hey, this is like a way to get out of a slump or what. I think I was 9 for 95. It's like, dude, give me the freaking bottle, bro. And, I mean, that's at the point I was. And at times through the course of my career, just about every single year, I'd have like a little bottle of Crown there. And if it felt like, boom, before the game. And I'm not really a huge drinker, right?
Right.
It's not – again, it's not something
– You can't run 100 miles and be a big drinker.
Yeah, but I even now it's funny because I used to go out and go out and have a good time, and you're out till late, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, you're hitting the clubs and everything else. Now it's like, dude, I'll have one. I've turned into the exact drinker that I used to never be. I used to drink sometimes to get drunk. I used to drink.
Oh, yeah.
Total social, nothing else. Now.
People get way more interesting over 10.
Yeah, of course, dude.
So, even yourself?
Of course.
You find out things about yourself?
But now it's like I'll have a glass of wine.
Right.
Maybe 2 glasses of wine. And if I'm feeling frisky, I might take it to 4.
Or a couple Deschutes boot porters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Up at Martis.
Sure, but, dude. Or we can go to or we go to my house for my 40th birthday party, and I got absolutely shit-faced. So,
and showed up about 4 hours late,
which
was awesome.
I apologize about that. That's the electric car's fault that went dead.
That solar power.
Going up the 80.
it was fun. Like that. And that.
In the playoffs, you're down 0-3. Is that when it started, or did it start before that?
No. That's a good question. I think so.
That's when it started.
I think it started like that and just became superstition. But I didn't take – you know what? I personally – you know what happened? I didn't take shots that round because I didn't get it the first day, and I was superstitious. Like, no. And like whoever it was like, hey, you got it. And I'm like, no, I didn't take one the first time. Don't give it to me. And I didn't take one. Now, I did it some other times and you know but, yes, that time and that ALCS, I didn't personally – take one because I was so superstitious because I didn't do it that first night. And that's the beauty of sports, right? How many times did you go to the same restaurant the next day after going like 3 for 4?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I would walk the same path. You know, the beauty of sports is we really sometimes the superstition in it. And I wasn't like, you know, Nomar with like the whole, the you know, getting the batter's box, left, right up the steps and all that. But it was more like, okay, I went to this place for lunch. I'm going to go to that place again. Or I went there for dinner, or I drank this beer last night. I'm going to have this beer again. You know, just different things like that, which were really unique and fun.
2008 and 2009, I mean, you just put up ridiculous. A 961 OP. I mean, we could go back, golly, dude, 3 years in a row. 8, 9, and 10, you had over a 958 OP. You became... You were a nice feel good story, and it's, hey, Kevin Youkilis, Greek God of walks, gets to the big leagues, helps the Red Sox win a couple World Series. Then you turned in, excuse my language, to a fucking superstar, dude. What was that like in Boston with those people?
Well, I don't know if I was. I felt like, you know, I became an all star, which was cool. There's so many other superstars. I felt I never thought I was that good. I always thought I could do better. And my biggest problem in my life was I was always a perfectionist. And I always kept a chip on my shoulder from the days where University of Cincinnati and Butler were the only two Division I schools that offered me a scholarship to not making first team after, you know, batting, you know, like the batting title in college and all that stuff. So for me, it was always I wasn't good enough. I wasn't good enough. I got to get better. I got to get better. Like that. And the same way I live life now, I'm just never satisfied. Like, and I've gotten better over time with that. And it's kind of a great thing to have. And I think that's my attitude that I had was I was always trying to get better. And now if my body held up just as much as my mind would hold up of trying to get better, it would have been a lot better in a lot of ways. And I could have done things better. With weights or taking care of myself in a lot of ways, which I beat myself up sometimes about. But, you know, it was a wild time, and it was hard for me because I at times have social anxiety and have a hard time with being in the spotlight. And it was not an easy time for me. And I had this attitude and this negative vibe sometimes, and I didn't do the best job I possibly could when I was in Boston. And as much as I did a lot of great community stuff and my charity, we raised a ton of money. At the time, I just lived in this tunnel. And I didn't want, like, going to Starbucks, I was like hoping there wasn't a line, or I went here and I didn't hope there, you know. And I didn't embrace it as much as I should have in a lot of ways. I know I could have done a better job looking back. And it's probably part of my perfectionist. And some people tell me, no, you were great, whatever. And some people say, oh, you know, he was an asshole. And if I was an asshole to people, a lot of it was my insecurities of I just wanted to be an average Joe off the field. But during those games, I wanted to be Ted Williams. I wanted to be that statue out there where I could get up and get the big hits and do all the great things and be the best player I could be and win games for the team. And just, I loved it. There's nothing better than that ninth inning. Even if I wasn't up to bat or on the bases, like in the dugout, running out and just being with your teammates and slapping them, and we'd punch, and, you know, like, that was the glory. And we were in such a great era in Boston. All sports were dominant. And it really at times wore on me. It really wore on me. And if I could go back and do one thing better, it would be embrace it all. Embrace it all more and stop grinding. I'd grind it with myself. I'd grind with people sometimes. And I think that was my biggest issue a lot of times, was just letting insecurities or being scared of certain things not, you know, it's okay. Let it go. Like, don't worry about it. Like, if somebody comes up to you and wants a picture, it's okay. If somebody wants this, it's okay. Like, I would just try to avoid those situations. I always want to put myself, it's kind of funny, in the best chance in my life to not fail. Just like in baseball, you set yourself up to work hard, to try not to fail. I did the same thing outside. And at times, it was a grind.
Your social anxiety, where does it stem from? How far back does it go?
Well, a lot of it's my sweating. So I've always been a sweaty guy. And it's funny, like, you know, people make fun of that all the time. Like, oh, you're the sweaty. It's like, I didn't really choose this, you know. And I'll never forget the first time. Like, it was pretty funny because I was playing goalie when I played soccer back in the day. And it was a practice in the fall or something. And in just the temperature, like, so my head was steaming. So it had this steam coming off. And one of my best friends still this day, like, always jokes about that day. He's like, dude, your head was steaming. Like, it's so cool. You're kids, you know? And then it just became like a thing where I was just always, you know, no matter where I am.
So this goes back to high school?
Oh, yeah, teenage years and all that. Like, I just.
But I could see it bothering you. And you talk about, like, the teenage years, right? We're all insecure when we're 16, 17 years old.
The worst.
But.
Well, some have it that, you know, but some don't, you know?
All of a sudden, but you, again, you became a cult hero. And it's kind of the theory of, I don't know. I mean, who cares if you're sweating, right? Right? Like, that's.
And that's the thing. Like, now I know more than ever, and I fight it and battle with it now. And it's funny. And when you go to therapy and you go do all, and that's the greatest thing I tell people too. I say, why are we so scared to go to therapy? Does it make us less of men and women in life, or are we scared to talk about our flaws? We all have flaws. We all have problems. And that's the one thing I hope to pass on. Like, so I'm doing all this stuff now in my life to try to get myself where I can do all these things and not worry about it. But it's funny, like, it was like something like a presidential thing, or they're talking about being sweaty. I'm like, well, I have no chance of being president. Like, put me in a suit and a tie, I'm sweating, you know? Like, and that's the running joke, you know? So luckily I'm never going to run for office, but, you know, it's funny that it was things that it eats up in my own head. And that was the greatest thing about marrying my wife. She's like, I never even care. Like, that's not like, and most people, like you said, don't care, but it's our inner insecurities that we think too much, or we overthink it. And that's probably my biggest thing right now.
I don't know Julie very well, but from the limited interactions that I've had with her, she probably seems like, she does seem like one of the most genuine people that I've ever met in my life. Now, I think a lot of people know this at this point. You married into a pretty athletic family. Julie is Tom Brady's sister.
That's correct.
What has that been like?
Oh, there's a lot of good and there's a lot of bad. No, I'm just kidding. It's good. It's a great family. It gets brought up like recently, and times get tough at certain points where people start going crazy in the media and fans start acting ridiculous in a lot of ways. And that's the hardest part of – the hardest part for me is seeing family hurt feelings, just the nastiest things said about people that don't have any idea what kind of person somebody is and what their family has to go through. And it gave me such a better perspective of how at times I didn't see what my family went through. And being in Boston, or, you know, Yankees fans and things said, or and how my parents wouldn't wear Red Sox gear, you know, at Yankee Stadium out of fear. And the old Yankee Stadium, of course, not the new one. The new one's a little easier. But, you know, I've gained such a good perspective on that, that I appreciate everything my family went through and how much of a struggle that probably was for them to read bad things and read nasty things and hear nasty things. I'm nowhere near the level of my brother-in-law. But for me, that's the hardest part of being Tom Brady's brother-in-law, is hearing the negative that is said about him with people that have no idea, you know, and that's what's hard. But the positives are they're a great family. They really, really love each other more than anything. They're all just, you know, they have this competitive nature to them. So, like, when we go on, you know, trips and stuff, we, you know, and we, there's always competitions or something's going on, or we go to Montana and there was whitewater rafting and we had two different rafts and who could get down the river faster. So that's what I love about that family, the competitiveness. You know, in my family, you know, like, we compete and do all that too. So it's fun. Like, the competition is fun. Competition is great. You know, these people that say, oh, losing, it's okay to lose. Like, competition, win, loss, it's fine when you're kids. It's okay. Competition builds a lot of great things in life. We look at it as a negative thing. But it's great. I mean, I really enjoy it. I'm very blessed to have a great mother-in-law and father-in-law that truly love me and treat me so well. And, you know, and just her whole family. Like, I get along well, and our parents get along. And it's such a great, you know, vibe that, like, those little things when they reoccur, like this whole Deflategate thing and all this, the negative that has is so minuscule to what the overall brand of being married to Tom Brady is in the family. Because the joke is, the original, you know, he's Tom Brady Jr., but the original Papa, as we call him, is Tom Sr., is just a wonderful human being, a wonderful man that would do anything for his kids. And that has been passed on to his three daughters and his son too. So we have fun. We have a lot of fun. And I just wish people would understand that, which, you know, I'm talking to an audience that, some people will get it, and some people are envious and will never understand because they see money or fame and this and that. But, you know, quite honestly, it's not an easy life sometimes for Tom and what he has to go through. But he does a lot of great things for a lot of people, and I'm proud that he's my brother-in-law.
It's interesting because this is the greatest quarterback in the history of the NFL, in my opinion. Obviously, that's up for debate.
Oh, yeah.
But here he is, and, you know, having a relationship with you. Now, I grew up playing football and baseball against Tom Brady, and ironically, the 2 years that we played against Sarah in football, I went to the football high school in St. Francis, and he went to the baseball high school. Sarah, who had Barry Bonds and Greg Jeffries and Jim Fregosi, Lynn Swan actually went to that school as well. And here we were, the football superpower, in 2 years. I think it was 66-6 and 62-0 that we beat Tom Brady.
And I think they didn't – his freshman year of football, I don't think they won a game.
It's incredible. Well, that's what he was dealing with. Like, his team, they just weren't a football school at that point. Now, since, they become a lot better. But when I think back to Tom Brady as a high school athlete, dude, the first thing I'm going to talk about was his quick release behind the plate. He was an unbelievable catch. I remember sitting there and marveling at him taking infield. And then the other one is he hit a home run at St. Francis. Absolute bomb. The furthest ball I ever saw hit in high school. Across the street, out in right field, across the street, it landed on top of a planned Parenthood building. Now, I don't know what's more ironic, that Tom Brady hit the furthest ball I'd ever seen in high school, or that there was a Planned Parenthood building across the street from my Catholic high school.
That's
right.
That's actually really ironic. That's actually awesome.
But he, I mean, he's almost like, I don't see a mythical figure, but even, you know, here he is. He married Giselle.
More scrutiny follows.
The world's greatest supermodel. And you think that they lived this life that's totally, I don't know, I think free of outside influence, free of, dude, I'm Tom Brady.
It's like a Disney movie.
This is my wife, Giselle. Yet when something like this comes up, just talking to you through this process, it's interesting to me And it makes sense when I go to think about it more, how hard the family took it.
Oh, you can't put it in words because you have children. You know, I have children. And just think about if somebody was saying something bad about your child at elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that kid, you know, oh, he's such a, you know, brat.
Yeah.
As a parent, what happens?
My kid is a brat, all right?
My kid is a brat, but guess what? You can't say that about my kid. I can, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like the same, you know, well, not the same in a lot of ways, but, you know, that's – and the greatest – you know, one of the things, too, about, you know, Tommy and that and this whole thing is – it's funny. We joke around, and we ran a race in Montana last year. And was it two years ago? I came back – and my plantar fascia went. So we're just joking around and, you know, being the athletes and – so that the whole family starts running, right? Giselle's running, Tommy's running. Julie and Tommy's niece, who signed to UCLA for softball, she's a freshman, awesome. So she's like fast, right? So they're all running a race. And I'm like playing with the kids, like throwing like the ball, and they're running. So I'm like, all right, that's it. I'm getting in. I go and I book them all.
Nice.
I book them all, and they're all like, what? Like, you know? And it's so funny. I joke around, tell that story how like, I'm like, listen, Tommy isn't the most superior runner, like in the world, but he's gonna work hard.
Yeah.
Where like if we raced again, he's the type of guy that he's gonna want to beat me.
He'll figure out a way.
Hopefully not, but that's what makes him the best because he doesn't accept failure. And if he does fail, it's a lesson within the failure. And that's the greatest part about, like, you watch all the stuff and what he does and playing the quarterback. You look at his combine. You look at the picture. You look at all the stuff. You look at him. He's not Cam Newton. Cam Newton is – I saw him in an airport. Oh, my God. Chiseled. Huge.
Yeah.
That's not Tommy. You know what Tommy does? He's going to go in. He's going to figure out scientifically how to get his body in the best shape possible for what he does best. He's not a middle linebacker. He's a quarterback, and he's going to figure out how to do that. And that's what he spent so much energy and time on in his life is picking defenses apart. How is the offense going to work? What can we do to get better as a team? How can I get myself better? All that stuff. And that's what's made him the future Hall of Famer and one of the best quarterbacks, if not the best quarterback of all time. You know, it's funny. Like, I think, I mean, I'm jaded, you know. So, I mean, not jaded. Well, he's the best quarterback because he's my brother-in-law. Like, that's what I think, truly. But I honestly think that outside of the realm of family, I think what he's done has been remarkable. The amount of times they've won their division is it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but also going back to the whole thing is the fairy tale life that everyone thinks it is. One day I was in New York with my wife when I was playing in New York, and I had my back surgery and stuff like that. And Giselle was in town, and we went to – she was at this wherever in New York. And next thing you know, we go out to do something. We're going to lunch. Paparazzi. Paparazzi's following. And we went two different places. I'm telling you, by the end of those two different places, I was ready to absolutely choke somebody out.
Yeah.
Until you deal with paparazzi, which, listen, I thought I was a pretty
you thought you were
significant
the man. Yeah,
person
sure.
when I was in Boston.
Yep.
I had people with cell phones maybe taking a picture of me at a restaurant.
Yeah.
These are professional photographers that jump on motorcycles in these cars. The chaos. And I turned around in the car and looked, and Giselle's like, I'm so sorry, guys. I'm like, you never apologize to me for this.
Oh, dude.
This is the disgustingness of people that are trying to make money or do whatever. And I'm telling you, it was the – until somebody can actually live that. I mean, Alec Baldwin's like – I was ready to pull an Alec Baldwin. Like, I was ready to just like – just choke somebody out. But until somebody can see that life,
yeah,
I'm sorry. And like I said, there's nothing – they live a great life. They have great things, a lot of great kids that are just awesome, good people, like all that stuff. They have great family. So they're, you know, but this little thing of the paparazzi is so wild. And you got to see it one time. I don't know if you've seen it.
Oh, I've seen it. It's terrible.
It's so bad.
But believe it or not, I actually saw it. I was with Mark Consuelos.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Mark's a good dude, a buddy of mine, and we were just going out to lunch. And they were there, just like, you know, I don't think they were there for Mark Consuelos, but just because it happened to be Mark Consuelos, let's snap some shots coming out. And it's intense. And I always said, that I felt like, and my status was never what yours was in Boston.
You were a cult figure with the A's, though.
A little bit in the
if
Bay Area
slid,
because I grew
if
up
If you would
here.
Have slid in Boston, you would have been the biggest cult figure in Oakland A's.
It wasn't the slide. No,
I was at that game.
I slid. Yeah, I slid. Your boy Tech fucking blocked off the plate. And then all I needed was the home plate rules implemented 10 years ago when they should have been.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
You can't block home plate without the ball. Now, where I fucked
10
up.
10 years too late, buddy.
Where I fucked up.
Or early, too early.
Is I thought that I had touched a plate and I went flipping over.
I remember
and I
that.
Was just pissed.
I was there.
Bro, I got up. My first instinct was like, this dickhead just tripped me. As I'm sliding into home plate, but I still felt like my foot had gotten the plate. I thought my knee was blown out. My first instinct, I push him.
Yeah, you looked hurt.
I push him out of the way. I take like 3-4 steps. I'm just kind of dazed. He goes and picks up the ball, tags me out. I'm like, oh shit, that did
and people
not
don't,
just happen.
And people don't realize in sports until you play a sport at the highest level. So what? Yeah, the major thing that we always talk about in sports, right? The game to Barry Bonds, the game to Tom Brady, the game to LeBron James is in slow-mo compared to the young player that might not be the best on the field, but the game's too fast. And the reason guys stay at that level is the game is so fast and you have to make so many quick decisions. And how many times you make the wrong decision in baseball, right? But the time that play happens so fast, mm-hmm. but you could watch it over and over and you're like, it's an eternity, right? You know, you're like, oh, my God, what if I would have just gone back and touched the plate?
You know what the funny thing is that I came up a lot like you in the sense that when I watched you, and even since I've gotten to know you, you don't give a fuck. Like, you're going to go out there, and you're going to do what you do, and you're going to let – there's going to be outside opinions and influences and everything else, but – when people ask me about you, I say, this dude's real. This dude is who he is. And I take pride in that. And look, I was goofy. I wasn't pretty. I you know, would butcher routes in the outfield. And my swing wasn't a pretty thing to look at. And everything I did kind of looked awkward. I threw awkward. I ran funny. But I felt like I didn't care.
Hunter Pence-ish.
Yeah, a little bit. And no,
but nowhere near the swing, though. You had a better-looking swing than that.
But very, very, very much so Hunter Pence-ish. So when I came up, it didn't matter. Like, dude, I'd do rundown drills in spring training.
Oh, they
in
hated Big League you.
They hated me.
I could tell.
Hated me. Hated me. The Triple-A team, literally, like had a mark on me. Like these dudes wanted to kill me. We ran 4 laps around. We had a fitness test in the Oakland A's minor league system, and all it was run 4 laps around the field, which is basically a mile.
Right.
4 laps around the field in under 7:30. Everybody knew it was there. Everyone, and you do it the first day. I lapped everyone. Lapped them. I finished in like 5 minutes, under 5 minutes.
Right.
And
you're showing me up.
Could you imagine? Exactly. And that's what it was. Well,
I'm not showing you up. I'm competing.
In spring training, I'm here fighting to make the big league team.
Right.
I happened to take out Enar Diaz at home.
Yeah, oh, no.
I did.
Oh, no.
And, well, I was dead in the water. It was a contact play. He got the ball. He was there blocking, took him out. Through the course of my career, whether in the minor leagues or the big leagues, because that play was part of the game,
hell yeah.
The number one thing I would think about going into home plate every single time was if I have an opportunity, I'm going to blow his ass up.
I'm right there with you.
Simple as that. Now, what Veritek did, and I knew this, we talked about this in the scouting report, what he would do is he stands out in front of home plate. And then at the last second, with or without the ball, it doesn't matter, he would stick his foot across. So he stuck his foot across the plate, and that's when I slid in, came over the top, dazed and confused, tags the ball out. Of course, A's fans, I'll still hear it from them. I mean, to the point where I was at an A's game, and I for the majority, love A's fans.
Right.
Right. And
they're fun.
They're fun. They're fun.
And they're fun because they get on you, too.
And they get on you, and they get on you. And say, I literally was at an A's game with my family last year. Took them to get, bought my own tickets.
I remember.
I was sitting there. And there was a dude, like two sections over, like, Burns, Burns. And I had, for the most part, kept a really low profile there. And it wasn't, you know, I kind of turned and like waved. And he looks over at me. You should have touched home plate with the middle finger out. I'm like, you got to be kidding me.
Just think if that was Boston.
Well, hey, look, it's not. It doesn't matter. It's something just as athletes, and it's unfortunate. Now, no matter.
But that didn't win. Like, but that one play did not win or lose a game. Well,
yeah, you don't know. Okay.
And you could have got swept in the next series.
Whether it did or didn't, I have no idea. Now, I also.
Let's be honest, though. You guys in Oakland going to New York, what always happened in New York for years? Wasn't there a curse of Oakland and New York?
We had an issue with New York. Yada yada yada. I also hit over 400 in that series. I hit like 460 in the series. So
I remember it.
Look, it's the game, bro. It's life. It's everything's not always perfect. You look back on the situation. I will say that I'm not kidding you, I spent the rest of my career. The rest of my career looking for one opportunity to take Jason Veritek's head off. That's not a guy you want to try to
if you know when you collide with him.
I would have gone out. Trust me.
That you might get the best of him, but it's going to hurt. Like, because I did. I took out Navarro. Dioner Navarro I took out, and I put my – So, you know, you have to lower, you can't raise your hand. But somehow I had my hand on my chest or somewhere, and I broke my finger on the top part, hit his face mask. So I took him out safe, and I knocked him straight down, came back. I was like, oh, yeah, pumped up adrenaline. Next thing you know, I'm like, damn. Dude, I hit that pretty hard. And next thing you know, like, I found out, like, later, like, it was just, like, a fracture on this part, which is not a big deal because, you know, it's on the top of my hand. On the bottom of the hand, it's, you know, it would be bad, like hitting and all that. So sure. I played through it, whatever. But it's, you know, you hit, you know, those collisions, you know, you even if you knock the guy down as hard as you can, it's still going to leave a mark.
It's gnarly,
man.
Dude. It's gnarly for both parties. It's gnarly the runner, the you know, the catcher. But what do you think about home plate collisions, the new rule?
Well, and I'm a huge fan of this guy. I think Buster Posey is a hell of a player. But I think that rule is ridiculous in a lot of ways. I think the game has changed in such a way where, you know, you had it like if the backup catcher had the same injury, this is my opinion. If the backup catcher or the 29th ranked catcher in Major League Baseball that happened to, we would never have ever heard about it. It would never have been magnified to that level. I think Buster Posey, he wasn't at fault, but he didn't have the ball and he went to go tag. And I know a lot of Giants fans will kill me for this, but the poor kid that hit him.
Scott Cousins.
Was a San Francisco kid. Yep. Can't even live in the Bay Area anymore because of
University of San Francisco.
Because the hatred and just the irony within that is just terrible. But I didn't think it was his fault. Like, it's until you live it, until you go in hard, until you're playing the game as hard as you can and some catchers on the plate, as a runner, you don't have any other choice sometimes. When you're running full steam and you don't see white, you don't see any white, you can't just think, oh, I'm going to do this slide where I'm going to slide to the right, I'm going to put my hand out, I'm going to tap it with my finger. Like, that is not in your mind. Mm-hmm. You're running as full bore as fast as you can, and you're thinking, there's only one way I can get to this plate. I got to take him out. And most guys don't want to. I'd say guys like us that are a little crazier, you know, that will – you know, not scared of contact or diving or, you know, getting dirty and all that. Yeah, you're going to take guys out and, like, you're just playing the game. But I just felt like that rule alone is so weird now where catchers can't, like, hold it up. But a position player can sit on third base and put his knee down and block third base. Or first baseman can put his leg down in front of the base. Or a second baseman could put his leg down in front of the base.
Is that Chase Utley used to do that.
Yeah, and it's legal. Jason Bartley used to do it,
too. How is that legal?
It's legal.
Don't you have to provide a path to the base?
Exactly. But you know the funny part about it is there's so many.
I told Chase that, and it was funny because Chase
is awesome.
Chase is great. Chase is awesome.
And I hate that rule at second base is called the Chase Utley rule.
That's terrible too.
That is the worst. I mean, it's like calling. I mean, and this I don't want to bring up politics. It's just like calling the Affordable Care Act Obamacare. Like you know whatever. Like all that stuff. I hate when they put names to like all good or bad. If you agree with it, disagree with it. Like the Chase Utley rule. Like. His name does not need to be there. Like, you think that the rule got changed just because that one time? I remember when I was a kid, Ron Oster got taken out at second base. His leg snapped in half, and his career was never the same. So it's been going on through the history of time. There's so many rules are getting implemented now that and you're trying to look out for player safety, but it's always when it happens. The Mets thing happened on the big stage in the playoffs. You know, if it happened in spring training, no one would talk about it, right? Mm-hmm. It's just everything's magnified more. Media magnification of everything. I know you work for MLB Network, but, you know, it's like ESPN and just everything's a controversy. Everything's glory. Like, it's too big. It's too – just the game just – I sat there in the meetings in spring training about this slide rule. And so I said, hey, what happens if you got first and second – guy bunts the ball, catcher throws the ball to third, the guy running from second to third takes out the third base before he throws the ball to second base. Is it a triple play?
We just had a recent scenario of this that's happened.
Right.
And they actually did not reward them the triple A, but they –
No, it's only a double play. But I said, how can you decipher that? You're saying one is a double play because that's the only plays you have, but how could you say it's not a triple play?
That's a great question. You foreshadowed that because it happened.
So I asked.
This is great.
I asked him in the meeting, and I was talking with Joe. Like, yeah, this is what I bring to the Cubs. You know, meetings. I joke with Joe and like Theo. I'm like, yeah, you hire on Jewish minds. It's just always moving around. You know? But no, I asked that question. I said, well, how could you say that that's only a double play? Because the number one rule in baseball is what? You can never assume a double play. I don't know if that's the number one rule, but it's one of the number one rules of number one rules in baseball, right? So you're saying you can assume the double play, but you can't assume the triple play if a guy does the same thing. Because think of you have double steal, third baseman gets the ball, guy takes him out, and he's ready to throw to second base, ball goes launching into right field. That's a triple play, probably.
Yeah.
Because he's covering the base, ball's hit hard, it's a triple play. It just happens, right?
So you're basically, you don't like these rules. You don't love the home plate rule.
I don't love the home plate rule, because I think, well, there's two. First reason was because the whole Buster Posey thing, and like I said, I love Buster Posey. It's not like, oh, I'm envious of, you know, like some guys are like, screw Buster. I'm like, dude, Buster Posey's the best player ever. Now him saying what he said, probably, you know, he should have been more, you know, to Scott, he should have been more gracious. Like, it wasn't on purpose. He wasn't trying to end his year or whatever.
You're saying Buster Posey should have said more stuff like that.
Yes. Okay. I mean, but that's his call. That's not my call in life.
Sure.
What I think, I mean, he could tell me whatever, you know, it's like, it's just differences of opinions. But the second part is, I just think that too many games are going to be won and lost now by that rule.
What about electronic strike zones?
Oof.
Obviously, David Ortiz.
I know. I knew you were going to ask me this too, because this is one of our number one debates.
Yeah.
I think there's two parts of it. One, you're going to unemploy a lot of people.
I'm going to employ more people.
How?
I'm going to add an extra umpire. I'm going to put him in the booth to control the electronic strike zone to put him at an IFB on him, an IFB.
So why would you need a home plate umpire?
For all sorts of things, check swings, foul tips, everything else.
Well, you don't need it.
You need him.
Why?
You have to have him. Why? Because he's got a ton of
responsibility. You're going to tell a guy to sit back there and take foul balls off his mask all day for what?
To call balls fair and foul? You have a responsibility for that, for foul tips, to see if the ball actually hits the batter?
Okay, so you have all the computerized stuff, right, for a strike zone?
Yes.
Why wouldn't you have a computerized thing for foul balls?
You basically do with the replay system now.
Right, so what I'm saying is if it's all computerized, you have lasers.
No, because you need humans out there, it's more efficient.
You have lasers. You have lasers on the foul lines, right, from – You have lasers in that could tell you if it's fair or foul. You have judgment calls anyways, all that. I personally think there's a good element, and I know you – listen, there was days I hated strike zones. They were horrible. And what happened the other night was it was bad. It was really, really bad. And the only reason I say it's bad is, and I actually had a conversation with Ron Colby. We stayed at the same hotel in Scottsdale. My parents, my dad was actually talking to him in the hot tub where we were staying. So I come down to meet my parents, and Ron Culp was there having a beer.
When was this?
Last year in Scottsdale.
Okay.
So I'm like.
So he was the umpire the other night with David Ortiz when David Ortiz had two calls against him.
That were pretty. One was really rough, but I will say it looks a lot worse than the way McCain caught it, but it still was horrible.
Correct.
It still was for a major league game, bases loaded, 3-1 count. Like, that was awful. Whatever. And umpires make mistakes. But Ron sometimes gets a little bit, you know, the one thing I can say about Ron is when you sit there and talk, I mean, he's got a little edge to him, he loves hockey, he's got a little edge to him. And I got along talking with him, but I got into it with Ron Culp in Miami one time that I literally lost I lost it.
Like, was he the home plate umpire
at the time?
Just on he called on a strike zone call?
Yeah, I was facing Heath Bell, the reliever.
Sure.
Yeah. And I'll never forget it. I mean, it was just terrible. And this was 2012, a bad year in my life. But horrible call. And I flipped out. It was the end of the game, like all the stuff. And I'm like, are you kidding me? And we just go at it. Because he's very combative. He'll be very combative. And he's one of those umpires that he'll get into it. He won't, And some days it's okay. Like, but when you go and you get these umpires that kind of love it, they love that, going back and forth. That's when the strike zone can be a little bit of a problem. When, and you hear all the guys before us like, oh, man, these guys used to screw us. If we had one incident with them, they'd screw us for the whole year. And
it's terrible.
And that's your argument.
To think that the three most important people when it comes to a Las Vegas betting line on a game of baseball are the two starting pitchers and the home plate umpire, that's a problem.
Now we're going off betting.
Well, I didn't know. It goes to show you how important the home plate umpire is. And if the home plate umpire is that important and they have such a difficult job, why would we not give them assistance?
I've heard the argument, and I don't think it's crazy. Like, some people are like, that is ludicrous. It's not crazy.
No.
It's not crazy to say that, but the only thing I don't see is the consistency of the Mika strike zone or whatever. I don't know if it's a Mika.
Pitch FX.
Mm-hmm.
Sports fish. It's an inch.
I think of the Red Sox one. I'm just used to that from when I played there. I think it was the Mika strike zone or whatever. The brand name was a Mika or whatever.
Throw an advertisement on it.
Right, there you go. That's the only thing I would have a hard time with is I've seen so many different ones that show it where it is and isn't. Until it was perfected for every player height and all that stuff, and you had the system where it was down pat every single time, you could, like I said.
What do you think the margin of error is for a human umpire that you've experienced?
Well,
give me inches. Up, down, sideways. Margin of error.
Depends on the umpire.
6 inches?
Well, the problem is, too, that you can have almost like two baseballs off the plate. Technically, because it's a baseball that's judged off the plate. So if
it's about 6 inches.
Yeah, so it's about 6 inches.
6 inches, right?
Yeah.
Margin of error, pitch FX is one. The pitch that was called on David Ortiz, the last one that was down, was 3.5 inches down.
Really? So what was the pitch FX on the one that was
a strike? That's terrible. It needs to be adjusted. I've said that.
Right.
I think that – so this – if I did the whole experiment with San Rafael Pacifics last year. June 17th of this year, we're going to do it again.
Okay.
HBO Real Sports is actually committed to do a whole special feature on it. And the only way this is going to happen is it's really – there's going to be so much demand for it and cry from the public that Major League Baseball is going to need to recognize it, and they're going to have to come together with the umpires union. And I understand Major League Baseball's stance on it. I get it. I just talked to a beat writer from – the Boston Globe the other day about it.
Alex?
Yeah, exactly.
Great guy.
I actually really, really enjoyed a conversation with Alex.
He's very intelligent. Writes. He's one of the writers I got along with the most.
Makes a lot of sense. I talked to him for half hour.
Great guy.
Really good dude. And, he just had some questions about it. But from my experience last year, what I feel like they need to do to perfect it would be there were some balls that were called that seemed ridiculously high there were balls that were called that seemed ridiculously low.
Okay.
I felt just through my personal experience, and I'm not sure if the TV ones are the same as the PitchFX ones.
Right.
But I will say this. From the PitchFX one that I experienced, you need to raise it a little bit.
Okay.
Raise the strike zone a little bit to you get to the point where it truly meets the definition of the strike zone. You need to lower it a little bit. So all of a sudden, right, we're making it less here and give a little bit off where it's – if it's – because you can reach a ball. You know this. As a right-handed hitter, if that ball is off and away an inch, you can hit that pitch. You
yes.
can still easily hit that pitch. Whereas, you know, inside, whatever. But once you figure out and take Major League Baseball players, use them as the experiment goats. Is, okay, this, yes, this should be a strike. This should be a ball. And then it's uniformed. And then
right.
everybody's happy with it. Then if the pitcher dots an inch off the outside black, down and away, and then the other thing is that people are worried about it not adjusting to the hitter. It adjusts the first time the hitter comes to bat, it adjusts to the hitter. Every single time they were doing it, they were showing me exactly how it gets done in the truck. Boom, boom, boom. This is that hitter strike zone.
What happens if a guy has a different two-strike stance? Is that something too?
I don't know that. I do not know that.
Well, I mean, exactly.
This is still a learning process.
Right.
But you're
so
right. If
somebody spread, like I didn't. I mean, most guys.
You spread out. I did.
Some guys might have a different stance. With two strikes, so that might play in. I mean, I'm just giving you.
I'd love to be a.
If I could help out in any way of explain, like I said, you could sell me on it down the road. Like I have no problem with it. I'm just not sold because of the reasons we're talking about now.
Sure.
And you know, it's just one of those things that it can happen over time, but.
And it's only going to get better. The technology is only going to get better. I just feel.
I think the hard one too is the reason the down one's so hard. I think is because which knee does it hit.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
they cover it through when it goes through the front part of the plate.
Is it the front knee or the back knee?
Front,
you know, and that's the hard decipher. It should be actually in all reality, it should be down the middle of your stance.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about it, that's I mean, yes, you hit the ball out here, but if you get a pitch outside, right, as a hitter, you don't try to hit the ball off your front knee. You try to let it get as deep as possible.
Agreed.
Right. So.
It's not perfect.
Right.
It's not perfect, but it's a whole lot better than any human will ever do. Even with its imperfections, it is better than what any human can do right now. And it took 28 years for Major League Baseball to implement instant replay.
Right.
It might not shock me if this takes 28 years too, but eventually.
So your son's going to be screwed if he ever makes it to the major leagues. Those umpires are going to ring him up like left and right. You're going to be fighting for it.
Your dad is trying to kill my job. It's your dad that took away my ball and strikes calls.
Tom Hallion won't get to do his. Yeah, but what happens like ringing him up?
You ring him up. You call it.
How would they know though?
So this year.
So they have to wait.
This year.
Though.
You ready for this? June 17th, and I want you to come out. June 17th, I will be full gear.
How do you know that?
Full ready?
Explain to how it works.
Right? Full gear behind home plate, behind the catcher, just like any other umpire would be.
Right.
That will be me. I will be umpiring the game. Yet I will have an IFB in my ear, which will be connected to a fifth umpire that we will have, whether it's a guy from Sports Vision or an actual real umpire. I don't know yet. We're still trying to figure out these details. And he will be sitting up there in front of the computer screen. So when that ball comes across – and it's a ball or a strike, he puts it in my ear, and I give it the
So what's the time? Like, what was
the time's real time.
What's the average time, though, like from when the pitch hits the glove
Dude.
To when you say ball or strike?
I'll say it right away.
I mean, let's be honest.
I called the game last year from that spot. I called balls and strikes. You see it right away. So all
but
I have
you know,
to
hear- like if it's a fastball down the middle and it's an easy strike – you don't have to wait. You just call it a strike.
You could. And the umpire last year would do that just naturally a couple times. And I had to remind him that, look, dude, I'm calling balls and strikes from over here.
But in all honesty, the percentage of times that's going to be borderline.
You could implement it as a challenge system. But, you know, it gets a little sticky to say, hey, you have five pitches you can challenge through the course of a game.
Yeah, no, what I'm saying is.
Like you would with the Ortiz situation,
it's like,
right?
It's like, okay, so when they grade umpires with plays at first base, well, they got the call right because he was out by 45 feet.
Sure.
Right? There wasn't a bang-bang call. Yeah. Right? So, like, when they judge him and do all that, same thing with strikes. There's a lot of times where the ball gets bounced in the dirt and hits home plate. You know it's a ball. Like, you don't have to wait for someone in your ear. It'd be kind of how many pitches a game, and it'd be kind of fun to track that.
How many are missed? There's
or how many are close enough where, like, you'd have to wait. You know, like, how many are just right there, like, right down the middle that are easy strikes that the game just moves fast?
My point is, and the whole idea of the IFB is to show Major League Baseball, just show the baseball world in general, that we can have the game seemingly exactly how it's been in the past.
And how's the feedback, though, from the pitchers and hitters? The pitchers are going to be pissed.
Actually, the pitchers liked it.
Really?
The pitchers would – well, you
I would never guess that.
Catcher set up down and away, reaches back, up and in.
Strike.
Nicks the top of the strike zone on the inside corner. Strike three. Pitcher was pumped. He's like, oh, man, right? Because
right.
The feedback, the most resistant feedback, believe it or not, has been from catchers because it takes away their pitch framing ability.
Right. So Yadi, like Jose Molina, like
exactly.
That, he made a living off that. Like
exactly.
He could hit a little bit here and there, but he made a living off of it. I mean, great catchers.
Dude, so. I'm not taking any more of your time. Compelling stuff. We got to do this again. That is
for sure.
Fantastic, my man.
Yeah, anytime, man. You come down this way. Next time, by the next time, we'll hopefully have some beer on tap here at the house. Get some Loma Brews going.
Dude, that's exactly what we're going
to
do.
Exactly. And this time you won't have to sleep in your car. In Los Gatos.
Thank you very much. Can I sleep in this pool house?
Yes, you can have the bed, and you can bring the fam down. The whole fam can come down and have fun in the pool while we do this again.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kevin Youkilis. How much time do you waste each week trying to figure out what's for dinner? Kevin Youkilis, how much time? Now that your headset's not even on? A lot of time or no?
A lot.
Well, okay. Do you want to eat healthy?
Always.
Always. You always want to eat healthy, right?
Only when I'm hungover, though.
Only when you're hungover, but that's when you just want the grease.
But I don't
get hungover anymore. So. Dude, Julie just brought in whatever those were, these little like slider mini burgers. Do you realize how good they tasted? Anyway, if you want to eat healthy and the fridge is bare, you don't have time to buy groceries. And the last thing you want to do after a long day is cook. Makes a lot of sense. And you don't have a perfect Julie Brady Youkilis to bring you nice little sliders, and then you have an entire noodle dish sitting over there and crackers and everything else. Let me tell you about this revolutionary new takeout spot called Plate. Plate has made eating healthy easy with a daily menu featuring 9 mains and 12 sides. All of their food is designed with your health in mind, and they offer many options for people with specific dietary restrictions. I generally avoid gluten. If you want to avoid gluten, no problem. They will have something there for you. Think Argentine chimichurri steak, lemon dill salmon. How about seasonal squash raviolis customized with your choice of sides like roasted Brussels sprouts, grilled broccolini, or farro and almonds. The food is all pre-cooked and ready to plate. You simply order, pick up, and heat when you get home. To save more time, order in advance on their easy-to-use iPhone app or website. And even better, they offer curbside pickup so you can swoop your dinner up without even getting out of your car. Very easy. What's even crazier is Plate puts your food on an actual ceramic plate. No slopping out of a takeout container, your diner, let's call this dinner, that's two ends in that word, now has the gourmet feel you deserve. Reuse the plate at home or bring it back for $2 off your next order. And exclusively for the podcast listeners, Plate is offering a special 25% credit back for all first orders. Just mention my name, Burns, in the special instructions during checkout. Start ordering Plate today by visiting platesf.com or downloading the app Plate SF and begin eating healthy the easy way. Plate, modern comfort on the go.